Good evening. You are listening to BBC Radio 3. And right now it's 6:30 and time for Opera on 3, Mussorgsky's Hovanshchina, sung in Russian by Welsh National Opera. Here's Andrew McGregor.
Welcome to the heart of Welsh National Opera's Russian Revolution season here in Cardiff. And as opera director David Pountney feels even now, a work that informs us about the Russian character, which he says has survived stoically, bemusedly and heroically everything that the Russian state has chosen to throw at it over the last century and more. And in Modest Mussorgsky's epic historic drama Hovanshchina, The Kovansky Affair, a great deal more. Mussorgsky defined his musical mission as finding the present in the past. And to do this, he turned to turbulent times in 17th century Russian history and a power struggle between religious fundamentalists and west-facing liberals, between the forces of the old believers, of Tsar Peter the Great and of the Streltsy, the private army of the rebel warlord Prince Ivan Kovansky. And with me is Professor Anastasia Belina from the Royal College of Music in London, who's going to be unravelling the first part of this opera with me in a moment. But first, let's frame the opera before we get into the plot. Anastasia, just remind us briefly where Hovanshchina fits into the history of Russian opera.
Hovanshchina is a great drama, not just an operatic drama, but of course a national drama, drama of the people, drama of the Russian state, as Mussorgsky wanted to express it. In his own output, it remains one of the operas that Mussorgsky never completed and that has been completed by many people, but it stands as a monument to Mussorgsky's powers as a composer, as a great operatic inventor.
And just briefly, give us an idea of how much was left to complete when Mussorgsky died in 1881.
Well, he did not orchestrate the opera. Only two tiny fragments were orchestrated, so the entire orchestration work still had to be done. Out of the six scenes that we have now, the finale was not completed, and also the ending of the second was not completed. Whoever turned to the task of completing the opera had to make some sort of a coherent sequence out of the fragments that were left.
Well, Rimsky-Korsakov was first to complete Hovanshchina, but we're going to hear it in Dmitri Shostakovich's orchestration from the late 1950s and with Igor Stravinsky's ending. We'll find out more about that during the interval, but what about the staging itself? The curtain opens on a ruined building, piles of shattered concrete and toppled pillars with a huge wrecking ball hanging ominously overhead. So where are we? David Pountney.
Well, the piece is, in some senses, a kind of political debate. So the setting essentially is a kind of destroyed parliament chamber. Throughout the production, there are people populating the benches and the desks of the destroyed parliament. So it's almost as though the debate is still going on, although the chamber has been partially destroyed. It also references very clearly some of the constructivist artists and theatre designers of the 1920s and 30s, and the paintings of Lissitzky are referred to. So there is a kind of acknowledgement of a Soviet period of art, but in essence, of course, the essential debates between people facing East and people facing West and between religious fundamentalists and westernized liberals is identical with the debate that goes on to this day about what Russia's role is between Europe and Asia.
Director David Pountney. And for conductor Thomas Hanusch, this sense of contemporary realism is vital. After all, it's in Mussorgsky's score.
The music is not counted in a philosophical way. The music is very spontaneous. So it's an eruption of power, of violence, of love, of very gentle moments. Mussorgsky uses these characters, these very complicated characters, to allow us to look at very important and deep things of human life. For example, what violence, ignorance, whatever reason it is, can do. How can this harm other people? So this piece is very up to date.
Conductor Thomas Hanusch. Okay, so let's get to the plot. And at this point, you may find it helpful to have the Opera on 3 website up and running, as there's a synopsis, a cast list, and production pictures to help you fully appreciate what's happening here in Cardiff's Millennium Centre for this revival of Mussorgsky's Khovanshchina, especially because this time around, they're singing it in the original Russian, not the English translation they used a decade ago. Now, Anastasia Belina, we have to understand a little of the history and the politics that Mussorgsky is describing in his opera. It is complicated, but just give us the idea of the factions involved and the tensions between them, because this is based on historic events in and around Moscow in the 17th century, isn't it?
Indeed. I think it is best to understand this opera and the action if we think of the fact that Peter, who became to be known Peter the Great, in order to become the fully functioning Tsar, he had to overcome opposing factions, of which there were 3. So the Streltsy, or the Musketeers, then the Old Believers, the opposing religious sect, and finally the westward-looking faction, which is headed by the Prince Golitsyn.
And we're going to meet them all as we go. In Act One, we're in Red Square in Moscow with the Streltsy Guard discussing their savagery and murderous behaviour of the night before. The nobleman, or boyar, Shakloviti, who's allied with the regent Sophia, instructs the scribe to take down an anonymous letter accusing Prince Ivan Khovansky of fomenting disorder so that he can get his son, Andrei, onto the throne with the help of the Old Believers. And this is when we get to the first of the many crowd scenes that are such a vital part of this opera, which we'll chat about later on. Prince Ivan Khovansky rallies the crowd and promises to overthrow the boyars protecting the corrupt regent Sophia, who holds power in the name of the heirs to the throne, the young princes Ivan and Peter. Khovansky promises he'll defend the boy tsars to the exultation of the crowd, but can they trust him? Ivan Khovansky is sung by Robert Haywood, and he sees his character as an unpleasant warlord who achieves his aims through the power of his soldiers, the Streltsy. And then there's his son, Prince Andrei Khovansky, who's obsessed with a Lutheran girl from Germany, Emma. He captures her and is only prevented from raping her by the appearance of the main female character of the opera, Marfa, sung by Sara Fulgoni. Here's how director David Pountney sees her.
Mussorgsky had created this female character who is in many ways the leading character. She's in many ways the most powerful figure in the opera. And she is, in a sense, a mystic. I mean, she's a cross between a kind of messianic nun and Carmen. And Mussorgsky pulls out some of his deeply erotic, what you might call Persian music, so South Caucasian music, which she reaches for at certain moments. And she appears, you know, she's having an affair with Prince Andrei, the son of the warlord. She's in a slightly dubiously intense relationship with the priest Dosifei. She turns up in Galitzin's house and clearly has a kind of intimate contact with him too. So she is actually the kind of spider web holding together all the other characters. So you could say the woman, if you like, comes out as the most powerful figure in the piece.
David Pountney, and Marfa certainly seems to be sitting at the centre of the web. But now there's a bigger problem. Andrei's father, Ivan Khovansky, decides he wants Emma himself, and it's only the intervention of Dosifei, the leader of the Old Believers, that keeps father and son apart as they fight for the girl. Dosifei gives Emma to Marfa for safekeeping and leads his followers in prayers for Russia's spiritual well-being as the bells ring out around them at the end of the first act. After a short pause, the second act of Khovansky finds us in the residence of Prince Vasily Golitsyn, reading a letter as evening falls outside. So just briefly, Anastasia, give us an idea of who is Golitsyn. What faction or forces of the opera does he represent?
Prince Golitsyn represents a faction that is more liberal, more westward-looking, probably someone that Peter the Great would associate with much more. And, of course, Prince Golitsyn still wants to gain his own power, and he's representing on stage the regent Princess Sophia. Of course, members of royalty of the imperial family could not be represented on stage in Mussorgsky's time, so they had to be represented by default by someone else.
Well, Golitsyn reads out the love letter from Sophia, wondering whether or not he can trust her. And Marfa arrives in the guise of a gypsy fortune teller, predicting Golitsyn's downfall and exile. He orders his servant to drown her so that rumours don't spread of his predicted fate. And this is where we witness the conflict between two of the factions in Mussorgsky's opera. On the one hand, the warlord Chovansky, on the other, the more liberal Golitsyn. And then into the mix comes Dosifei, who we find out was once also a nobleman rather than the holy man he is today. Marfa reappears. She's been saved from Golitsyn's henchmen by Tsar Peter's troops. And when Shakhlaviti is announced, he reveals that his denunciation of the Chovanskys has resulted in Tsar Peter ordering an investigation. Their cards are marked. So it's time to meet the cast. Prince Ivan Chovansky is sung by bass Robert Haywood, Prince Andrei Chovansky by Adrian Dwyer, Prince Vasily Golitsyn by Mark LeBrock, Shakhlaviti by Simon Bailey, Dosifei by Miklos Sebastien, Marfa by Sara Fulgoni, The Scribe by Adrian Thompson, Emma by Claire Wilde, and the Welsh National Opera Chorus and Orchestra are conducted by Thomas Hanush. And with the applause for conductor Thomas Hanush making his way into the orchestra pit, we're about to enter the turbulent world of 17th century Russia with Acts 1 and 2 of Mussorgsky's Chovanshchina, the Chovansky Affair, which begins with the famously atmospheric prelude, Dawn Over the Moscow River.
gavarit Cangia punto d'un amor La rimono imana Puntru clasfaili Camieniem posem Aniem sa gaide La pustaza La baro imali Ais vola quida Miesta I zucac Nelam la zabrali Ай да космос страшник знак мне, ай да паля право люба. Та что видя мой гость из конец, у той конец. Сае водом с грама стерся на урода.
Ах, ты конец, у той конец. Ха-ха-ха-ха. Ну, кой чёрт, вас пана чант ец носит.
Так, ой, а пана чам, уж и утвери отбили. Я дико сам строчила прост.
Гуся точит, чернилище та господи, тут застрипет та.
Ваше лубика за мусья пьенству,
Скорена этот столбик ударит. Ha 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 ha
ha Со мною Бог милости тебе прислал.
Благодарим, добрый человек, а с грешней недостойный раб Божий не сподобился зрения.
Ладно, не в том дело, смекни-ка, Заказ, jetzt важнее с тебе.
Что ж настрочим, мигом настрочим, по урьяду, по уклону настрочим, доносит лихо.
Если ты можешь питку стерпеть, если ты мои со стенок не страшатся, Если ты сможешь от себе отвлечься, забить то, что дорого тебе, строчи,
Господи.
Но если когда-нибудь встречи со мной, ты видишь меня, оборони тебя, Господь, тогда
Знаешь, проходи, как и мимо, Добрый человек, он много посулил ти, Друг мой любезный.
Строчи, живо!
Вишки, дадлю тебя, герой,
Строчи!
Ну, сказывай, У нас брат комар носа не поточит, сказывай.
Царям, государям и великим князьям все великие и малия и белия России самодежцам. Настрочил.
Пусть не тлевайся, знай, сказывай.
Смешают московские стрелец Худина Аванский, Боярина князь Ивана,
Dana Sinajevo, Andrea, zamutit krasjad na gasudarstvije.
Nesol na hemal, viru pjesica.
Račnika,
Salem vos udari mi velik, vas jas se meleni ta i malija i belja roci, sa ma jas mi sa šaju nas kosije, sa me leč mi na hamac, e al kvar i vale ne nas ne vandre, sa mu ti, roz jam to su to sve.
Zvali na pomoć svaju pratil, kak bi car svajm nas uhiti, А для того из Нефец город прийти большим собранием. Народ смущает, что много больших бояр повел. А там мутит по всей Руси великая, по деревням, по селам и посадам, делом злым. На воевод, на власти поднять огня, честное христианство. Останет смута на Руси, тот раз избрать мне с тенья дождишь, чтоб старые книги любили, а на царстве московском сесть Хованскому Андрею.
Слава тебе, Господи, промчала прохладных, уж как я к ней люблю их, и сказать не можно, не люди свели, сущие свели. Что ни стукат кров, что ни квадет гонев напрочь, а в доме к скорби стони. И все это вишь, для порядка надо.
Живо в строку зайди. А мы живем не на похоронках, а когда Господь утешит и все сохранится, и когда объявимся
в похоронках, объявимся готова
вручить царевне, оборонить я Господь, смотри, помни.
Да что ты саяешь, не буду досадно, не низкотая птица, куда ж птица хочет, полномашна, как и пугали.
Ой, не хоти узнать, с кем имеешь дело. Ой, не но ты сказать, кто за человека, проклятый от века, дьявола ходатай. И с нынешних будущих прощай.
Скатертью дорога, прощай, вот чудака права, не вдомью кему корячая слава, и злёнка жизнь, и знамени Бога, и возвод, вот-вот как воротит, да всё ж, как подсмотришь, хоть силён и знамен, а нашего лета жена телком руки. По группу покойничка, а меня небо подкину, медви посрамне ему. Хе-хе! А ну, пошел! Ну, пойди на расправу!
Kapieriet, Bog, Bratze, Slog nas am Morgen, so strecken nur das Wort.
Ах, полюбит меня красавица, Ах, не тупите, о, тебя смеешь, А сейру землю.
Стыд меня!
Княжина, вибат.
francese caravolle o
Ach, siete miei alta miei on abito vams la te anna patiechi et ne ad anca lor fiam sparit sole un maene bucrati mai
Scusita, basibo
Bravo, Slavnie! Oh, Батюшенька, здравствуй, батюшка мой. А мне не веришь, радость моя, свет очей мои, что веселится. Великий день тот был, когда тебя, света моего, помять я то видела. Ела пеша из Воздвиженска, только от письки отпаяя тебя. Не помню, как зашла, шла и глучи. Царевна, забота тягостных, о благе государе младиш, страсти ты пути предана, мечте о минувшем наслаждении сейчас отдается. Верить ли в клятве женщины глаз тайн любимой сильной? Вечное сомнение во всем всегда. Нет, не поддамся я обману мечты, пустой одуряющих минутных наслаждений. Вам, конечно, верю охотно, но с вами осторожно ж надобно. Не то, как раз мне милость, а там голову напрочь. Осторожно, гетьман князь. Держись я чисто ты душевной и телесной, то
ну, кто там еще? А?
Колдовка, та, что на медный изволили визвать, пришла.
Своя ли голова на плечах у тебя? Ай, чужая!
Простите, князь, обмолвился. Та женщина, что часто к вам приходится
солить. Ну, кто же позвать?
Stop! Yeah. stoi a star in knigam, a dalce sam narod podskaže.
На ночь старине не шись, как влезу признаться.
Вишь, приток ас.
Елькарем же мне мечне ты школу отбедал. Ну что ж, гори на нас перевод, а собой келья бесовским. И свой назвали у нас прокладе танцы дьяволу году.
А себе извинение гори меня, я тебя не
Ты вечернее, ты того шел, за кем шел,
The Chovanskys are up to their tricks. The reported reaction of Tsar Peter at the end of the second act of Modest Mussorgsky's opera Chovanshchina, The Chovansky Affair, in Welsh National Opera's revival of David Pountney's production for its Russian Revolution season this year. The forces of Welsh National Opera are conducted by Thomas Hanush. The Streltsy warlord, Prince Ivan Chovansky, was sung by bass Robert Haywood. Dosifei, sung this evening by bass Miklos Sebastian. Prince Golitsyn, sung by tenor Mark LeBrock. Marfa, sung by mezzo Sara Fulgoni. Prince Andrei, sung by tenor Adrian Dwyer. Emma, soprano Claire Wilde. The denunciation of the Chovansky's plotting that was made at the outset by the noble boyar Shakhlaviti, sung by bass baritone Simon Bailey with the reluctant help of the scribe, tenor Adrian Thompson, certainly seems to be bearing fruit as the fanfares of Tsar Peter's troops sound ever closer. Well, Anastasia Belina has been listening with me in the Wales Millennium Centre here in Cardiff, home of Welsh National Opera. Anastasia, the contemporary resonances that David Pountney identified the first time he staged Chovanshchina a decade ago don't really seem to have dated in the interim, do they?
You're absolutely right. They are still as contemporary, and the story itself as contemporary as it was in Mussorgsky time and in the 17th century too.
And the way in which it's been staged here, identifying all of those issues and making parallels with contemporary Russia, it's an intriguing way of looking at the story of the opera, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's really fascinating. It's so powerful and so overwhelming and formidable. It's incredible to watch.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3's Opera on 3. There'll be more from Anastasia, the director, conductor, cast and chorus as well in just a moment, as we use the interval to prepare for the remaining three acts of Mussorgsky's Chovanshchina. But first, here's a reminder of some of the dramatic moments we've already witnessed. Reminder of the power and beauty of Modest Mussorgsky's score for Chovanshchina, which we're hearing this evening performed by Welsh National Opera in Shostakovich's orchestration from the end of the 1950s. And we'll talk about the ending by Stravinsky a little bit later. But Anastasia, take us back to the time Mussorgsky was actually writing Chovanshchina, begun in the summer of 1872. We might think of it now as a key component of Russian national operatic style, but when Mussorgsky was writing it, is that how he would have seen it himself? Was that his ambition?
if we remember that 1872 is only a decade after the first Russian conservatoire opened, and it was only 10 years since the first Russian-bred, Russian-trained professional musicians appeared in Russia, then it's probably quite difficult to talk about a real Russian national style as we sort of think about as we see it today. Of course, Mussorgsky himself was a member of what is termed the Mighty Handful, or Magucha Kuchka, and these five composers were, of course, concerned with finding authentic Russian national musical style. But for him, I would actually think of him as a composer who was seeking for Russian musical speech, I would say. He was concerned with finding a way to represent Russian speech in music, which would be still faithful to the language's natural inflections and nuances, but still connected to music in a way that would create some sort of a unity between speech and music. And so what we hear in Mussorgsky's music now, and what we come to think as his Russian style or national style, is really just that.
Now, Anastasia, how has Mussorgsky managed to take the Khovansky affair from the pages of 17th century Russian history? Climate of great political change, obviously, but to make an opera out of it. How much is fact and how much has he had to invent?
Actually, quite a lot of it is fact. He was actually working from a number of disparate sources, but still historical sources. He had a notebook which he filled pages and pages with accounts of eyewitnesses, with later historical accounts, and of various notes that he himself made. He was working on the libretto with the help of Stasov, of course. He was an aesthetic advisor to the Mighty Handful and a friend at that time. And together they compiled the story, which is based on history. Some characters are, of course, invented. They had to be. For example, the character of Dosifei, because the old believers did not have the organized clergy, so they don't have a historical head or historical representative, as opposed to Streltsy, for example, because Ivan Khovansky was a real historical person.
What about the politics of Mussorgsky's own time, 2 centuries after the 17th century events he's depicting in the opera? Do you think it was attractive to him as a story, the Khovansky affair, because he saw parallels with his own Russia?
In terms of historical and political goings on at the time, he was always interested in what was happening around him. And actually, there is a letter, the first letter in which he describes his first thoughts of the opera that he was about to begin. He reflects on the fortune of Russian people, and he says something enigmatic. He talks about this black earth or black soil and how it is being plowed by the tools which are made from foreign metal or from wrought by foreign means. So what he actually is saying, cryptically so, is that we are the Russian people, but we have been sort of made to follow or obey quite different and foreign to us rules. And perhaps he was referring to the Western modes of, you know, thinking of living, which I find quite interesting. And also, of course, we mustn't forget that he conceived this opera in the year which celebrated bicentenary of Peter the Great's birth.
It's also interesting examining the main characters, because for the most part, they're a pretty unattractive, unsympathetic bunch, aren't they? Mussorgsky doesn't seem to have been at any great pains to whitewash them, to deliver a romantic hero or heroine we can admire for their beautiful personality.
That is absolutely true. And actually, if we think of all the characters in the opera, it is only the old believers that come out of the whole thing pretty noble, one might say. They are the only faction that do not plot, you know, are not engaged in vying for power or throne, and actually they are the ones with whom we probably feel more sympathetic.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose it just proves that the chorus emerges as the most attractive multiple personality in the opera, if you like. So let's get the inside view from two members of the Welsh National Opera Chorus, tenor Gareth Dafydd Morris and soprano Angharad Morgan.
Well, the chorus has three roles, really. So we start as Muscovites, then we become a Streltsy chorus, and then we become Old Believers. So our role changes, and so our outlook on how we're feeling, all the emotions change throughout the whole piece. Also, the girls become slaves at one point. So it's a real emotional roller coaster for us because the outlook we have on everything changes every moment.
For me, the chorus, it just builds the emotion even more so because you have these magnificent voices on stage singing the roles, and then you feel like it's a bit of a competition musically between the orchestra, the chorus and the soloists. You know, the chorus are there, we have this big wall of noise, and then all of a sudden it's taken right back again and we become this much more quiet, receiving, pleading chorus, but still with this very deep tone, but at a pianissimo level, which is just incredibly moving.
It really shows the range of what we do at WNO, I think, and what this chorus does exceptionally well is to show that we can do everything, which is exciting.
Members of the Welsh National Opera Chorus speaking there. And what about Mussorgsky's musical language, orchestrated by Shostakovich? It's often a dark, spare, unusual sound, quite distinctive. The bells and massive ringing textures, already familiar from Boris Godunov. Also unconventional for its time in the way he writes for the leads. There are major solos for some of them, but almost not what you'd call conventional arias. Now, Anastasia, we haven't really discussed the ending of this work at all. It's not Rimsky-Korsakov, it's not Shostakovich, it's Stravinsky. What did he need to do to make this work?
Well, Stravinsky actually presented us with the ending, which is the closest we could possibly come to Mussorgsky's own ending, because Mussorgsky intended to end his opera on the traditional motif of the Old Believers. Rimsky-Korsakov had that information, and when he was orchestrating the opera, he did not take that melody into account, and he instead presented something of his own. What Stravinsky did is he went back to the melody which Mussorgsky himself had notated, and he used it in the finale. So the Old Believers are singing it as they are walking to their immolation act, and he also connected it with two other melodies which are also authentic Old Believers melodies that appear earlier in the opera. So we have the ending, which kind of dissipates quietly in the smoke of the Old Believers dissipating souls, and we are left with a question as an audience: what is actually right here? What is actually just here? Somebody's beginning, somebody's dawn, is actually somebody's demise.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3, and I'm Andrew McGregor at the Wales Millennium Centre in Cardiff for Welsh National Opera's revival of Mussorgsky's opera Chovanchina as part of its Russian Revolution season. Now, if you go to the Opera on 3 website, you'll find a synopsis, cast list and production photos to help steer you through the operatic version of 17th century Russian history. Two acts down, three to go, and at the beginning of Act 3, we're in the Streltsy part of Moscow, near the river, and we meet Marfa, sung by mezzo Sara Fulgoni, alone, outside the Kovansky's house. It's a major solo for her, as she remembers her love for Andrei Kovansky, who's rejected her.
Marfa is a very mysterious, deeply religious woman. She's in love with Andrei, and becomes a religious fundamentalist, really, and she is very fixed on saving André and everyone else. I'd say she's very, very strong. She has total conviction. She's obsessed with her mission, and she never doubts her path for a second, actually. She represents different things at different times. She's love and death and religion all mixed up.
Sara Fulgoni on her character Marfa. And Martha is confronted by a fellow old believer, Susanna, who accuses her of witchcraft and condemns her for her sinful passions. Dosife intervenes and accuses Susanna of being a daughter of Satan before comforting Martha, who tells him she just wants to die with André. The boyar noble Shakloviti is disgusted to see the drunken Streltsy sleeping. He prays for the day a Tsar will come who can raise Russia from its misery. The Streltsy wake with hangovers and start searching for more drink, only to be faced by their wives. Now, Anastasia, this is a great crowd scene, this one, isn't it?
It is, because the wives are actually telling us that they're fed up with their husbands cavorting and quite happy for the husbands to be actually punished for that.
And you get individual members stepping forward and telling their story and reacting and interacting. It's much more than just a block crowd, isn't it?
Absolutely, and Mussorgsky is doing a great job of characterising these individual characters on stage, so we really get this beautiful, colourful palette of stage action.
And for director David Pountney, this is one of the key moments in Khovanchina.
I think one of the amazing things about Mussorgsky's attitude is that he is absolutely non-judgmental about any of the people. And there's no better example of that than the Streltsy. The Streltsy are this barbaric group of a private army, basically, being commanded by the Khovanskys, who are sort of warlords, as we would describe them, so oligarchs with their own private army. And this army totally runs rampage, raping and murdering and behaving abominably. And we have this amazing scene where Mussorgsky gives them a piece of absolute Orthodox Church sacred lament. So it's as if you'd got the SS on stage, and when the SS are told they're about to be executed, they are allowed music of intense personal grief because they're just human beings. They may be horrible human beings, vile human beings, but Mussorgsky doesn't deny them their own sense of woe and misery and horror at the fact that they're about to be annihilated.
David Pountney. And returning to the orchestra pit once more is Thomas Hanush to conduct the third act of Mussorgsky's Khovanchina in this Welsh National Opera production at the Wales Millennium Centre in Cardiff. In the Streltsy quarter of Moscow, the old believers sing a hymn of victory over the heretical reformers.
Thank you. Ti magu shiru mai Грешный мир. Слышим я. not atlichich, nayem nikach.
Ich will euch heute nicht mehr klatschen, ich will euch heute nicht mehr klatschen, so soll man wohl ein Kind haben. Здорово! Yeah.
Ivan Kavansky has abandoned his private army, the Streltsy, and they have no option but to head home and wait to find out what fate and Tsar Peter has in store for them. The end of the third act of Mussorgsky's opera, Khovanchina, the Kavansky Affair, in this David Pountney production at Welsh National Opera, conducted by Thomas Hanush, with Robert Haywood as Ivan Kavansky, Sarah Fulgoni as Marfa, Monica Sauer as Susanna, Miklos Shebestyen as Dosifei, Simon Bailey as Shaklovitie, and Adrian Thompson as the scribe who was bringing the news of the Streltsy's defeat at the hands of Peter's troops. Well, Act 4 finds Kavansky on his estate, calling for a song from the peasant girls around him. Golitsyn sends a messenger, warning that Kavansky is in danger, but he dismisses him and calls for his Persian slave girl to dance. A moment in the score that's part Scheherazade, part Salome. Here's Robert Haywood as Ivan Kavansky, describing what we see on stage.
The scene for me basically takes place in a bath. I end up in there having berated my serving wenches for being boring, and I'm extremely overcome with vodka. And so the Persian slave is a single dancer who lives out aspects of my life. There are moments when soldiers are executed in front of me by the Persian slave with a machine gun. Obviously, a lot of sexual, seductive type activity. It is an extraordinary combination of like a drug-filled aura, but also combined with the reality of people being shot. And the dancer eventually ends up on top of this extraordinary ball, which is 2-3 meters diameter, not wearing very many clothes. I have some clothes on, and there's a lot of blood. So, I mean, it's very visceral, it's very vibrant, it's very physical, it's very violent, but it's also very seductive and incredibly beautiful.
Robert Haywood. So, Shaklovitie arrives to summon Kavansky to a summit meeting with the Regent Sophia and Russia's High Council. He refuses to attend, so Shaklovitie draws a knife and kills Kavansky. By Act 4, Scene 2, we're in the square in front of St. Basil's Cathedral. A crowd of Muscovites gathers to watch Prince Golitsyn, in disgrace, being sent into exile. Dosifei and Marfa, meanwhile, discuss the fate of the old believers. With Peter's troops about to move against them, they see no choice but martyrdom. Andrei has lost his power, and Marfa offers him sanctuary among the old believers. The Streltsy prepare for execution, egged on by their wives, until fanfares announce the arrival of a pardon from the young Tsars Ivan and Peter. The final act is all about the chorus and the martyrdom of the old believers, including Dosifei, Martha and Andrei. Let's get the inside view from the chorus of Welsh National Opera, soprano Angharad Morgan and tenor Gareth Dafydd Morris.
We're following our leader, Dosifei, who is this sort of messiah-like being to us. And we have all decided that we are going to give ourselves to God. In this production, we are all gassed, which is really quite moving, but also very difficult because the music is Stravinsky, but not like you've ever really heard him. There's this wonderful walking bass that goes on throughout the whole of it. This constant moving polyphony, and it's very strange because for the rest of the opera, we don't sing like that at all. It's the first time that's happened that we sing so sort of solidly, and that is incredible, really.
Knowing that we're all giving our lives, this moment, the women really do come together. We're friends doing this together, so there's no sense of loneliness about it, but that we've made this choice and we're really going to stick to it. One by one, we fall to the floor or we're overcome and we die.
Conductor and orchestra are ready and in place to begin the final part, acts 4 and 5 of Mussorgsky's Khovanshchina, beginning with Ivan Khovansky at home, surrounded by the peasant women from his estates, ordering them to sing something cheerful as he faces his fate.
Yes, Вы слышите?
Какой стояли княже?
Чего вам там изволить? Что вы шепчетесь? Пойте!
Позовите просите на всем мучинушка Гарьена. Дай тучок, все мучинушка Гарьена, все мучинушка Гарьена, и Агарочки пришло.
Пойте! Вот так!
Разумом окажем спасение. Martin Bach. Joy my posach Что суд подвоет, века жить, что верить. Thank you. Братья, в молитве теплой найдете силы предстать пред Господа сил. Боже правый, вот Елизавет наш, занесем ее осуждение, но в путь святого обновления исполним его. Отче, Yes.
The Old Believers, led by Dosifei, with Martha and her reformed fiancé Andrei Kravansky among them, collapse and die one by one, martyred, as Martha foresaw at the end of Modest Mussorgsky's opera Kovanchina, unfinished when he died in 1881. We've just heard the ending written by Igor Stravinsky after the orchestration of the rest of the opera made by Dmitri Shostakovich, both of them obviously full of respect for Mussorgsky's extraordinary score. And you've just heard Welsh National Opera's revival of David Pountney's production for its Russian Revolution season this year. And the chorus of Welsh National Opera is first to take its call, quite right too, as the Streltsy, their wives as Muscovites, Old Believers, the peasant women of Prince Ivan Kovansky's estate, and joined on stage to those cheers by chorus master Stephen Harris. And the soloists from within the chorus as well, Julian Boyce and Lawrence Cole from the Streltsy, Alistair Moore as Vasonofiev, Simon Crosby Butler's Pushka, Gareth Patrick Morris as Strezhnev and Dimo Georgiev as the servant. And now here comes the old believer, Susanna, sung by Monica Sauer. And the Lutheran girl, Emma, sung by Claire Wilde. And those cheers for someone we didn't hear, but who made their presence felt, the dancer Elena Thomas as the Persian slave in the Oriental scene. Now the scribe, tenor Adrian Thompson, who brought news of the Streltsy's defeat. Mark LeBrock now as Prince Vasily Golitsyn, the West-leaning liberal sent into exile. And Adrian Dwyer as Prince Andrei Hrovansky, who lost his father, his power base with the Streltsy, and his life in that final scene. Simon Bailey as Shakloviti, the Boyar nobleman. And here's Miklos Shevesken as Dosifei, leader of the Old Believers. He turns and applauds the chorus and the rest of the cast. Now here's Sara Fulgoni as Marfa, Mussorgsky's invention to hold the different strands of the plot together. And the man himself, Robert Hayward, as Prince Ivan Hrovansky, leader of the Streltsy, challenger of the Tsars, murdered by Shakloviti towards the end there. And the cast joining hands, bowing to the audience here at the Millennium Centre. They're just waiting for conductor Thomas Hanusch to make his way up from the pit. Here he comes, greeted by Sara Fulgoni and the orchestra on their feet now. The Orchestra of Welsh National Opera, led by Lowry Porter. And those cheers are for them. Well, Anastasia Belina has been keeping me company throughout the performance. And Anastasia, that final scene is such a powerful one, isn't it? The martyrdom. It's incredibly moving.
It is incredibly overwhelming. There are almost no words to describe how one feels after hearing it.
And I know you've not seen this production before, but what are you going to take away with you at the end of it? I suspect it's going to be, it's that score, isn't it? Mussorgsky's extraordinary music.
Extraordinary music, but also understanding of Mussorgsky as a real dramatist, how he's able to show the drama on so many levels, national and individual. It is simply incredible.
Well, Anastasia, thank you so much. That was Mussorgsky's Khovanchina, the Khovansky Affair at Welsh National Opera. As David Pountney puts it, an opera that transcends time exactly in the manner described by Mussorgsky's slogan, the present in the past. And he could easily have included the future as well. 17th century Russia brought to life in 21st century Wales. After which it's time to return you to London and Broadcasting House.
Andrew McGregor presented Mussorgsky's Khovanchina from the Wales Millennium Centre, and it was produced by Luke Whitlock. And as part of BBC Radio 3's Breaking Free, A Century of Russian Culture, there'll be more Russian opera between the 9th and 18th of November, including Rimsky-Korsakov's The Golden Cockerel, Shostakovich's Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, Prokofiev's The Gambler and Tchaikovsky's The Maid of Orleans. And you can find out more about those operas and about the production you've just heard by visiting the BBC Radio 3 website and following the links to Opera on 3.
On BBC Radio 4.
We had to go through a security door where you punched in numbers. And Geoffrey said, "It's all right, it's easy to remember. It's the Treaty of Utrecht."
Alexei Sale, the godfather of alternative comedy.
And I'm like, "Geoffrey, man, you got to change that. That's the first thing criminals go for."
With a mixture of stand-up and memoir. Alexei Sale's Imaginary Sandwich Bar. Next Thursday night at 6:30, and then available on the Radio 4 website.
Well, now on BBC Radio 3, a hurley or camorne is the name given to the stick used in the ancient Gaelic sport of hurling. In tonight's edition of Between the Ears, we're immersed in the world of stick makers and players, where dreams collide as two opposing teams prepare to meet in The Clash.
This is a story that begins in the earth and completes in the air.
See there? See that root? There, the handle of it's here. That's the only bit that's used.
A story of time-honored skill, gifted from father to son, a life bound by family and fraternity.
That's my dad there now, I'll just come wee shout.
Chainsaw that.
Torn from its roots, the ash reborn, the hurl emerges, hook, nose, or bass, rough, still alive.
The plank comes out of the toe here. There, we call this a toe. It's the root, it's where the turn goes into the ground. Oop, of the bottom of the tree. And just that natural turn in the root is where the turn in the hurling stick comes out of the bottom part of it.
Tree as handsome on the soils of this earth as it is when scrubbed and scoured, shaven, sheared, shaken and struck like a weapon above it.
Concussions, lacerations, boys that have lost tips of fingers.
Broken ribs.
Broken bones, broken femur.
Fractured ankle.
Shattered bone fracture or a clean break.
So sacred. Letter in the ancient Om alphabet. Fuinchog.
I've always been around hurley making. My dad started it almost 40 years ago. It feels like it's just part of what we do, part of our DNA nearly, you know.